A really great reference for the inflationary part is this set of lecture notes by Daniel Bauman. Okay, so I'm going to use units where C equals H bar equals 1, define M Planck to be 8 pi g to the minus 1 half, and sometimes set this to 1, and use a metric with 1 minus and 3 pluses. Okay, so just to sort of ease into things, I'm going to start with by reviewing. This doesn't read. I'm going to start by. Oh, it's electronic. Okay. Ooh. Fun. Okay. So I'm going to start for the first lecture too by just kind of easing into things and reviewing a little bit, just because I think it's helpful, especially in this abbreviated short course format, to kind of see things a few times with different things emphasized. So I'll just start by let me start by writing down some FRW metric review. So the universe on large scales, if we average over its perturbations as we go to larger and larger scales. It's a good approximation to use the FRW metric. The motivation for this metric is symmetry. We observe a symmetry in the universe where we look out and everything looks similar in the angular direction. There are no angular inhomogeneities, large-scale angular inhomogeneities in things like the amplitude of perturbations, characteristic properties of galaxies, and so on. We don't observe a symmetry in the radial direction. We see those characteristic properties of the universe change. But it's reasonable to assume that this is simply a time translation invariance, which is broken. And so the observed symmetries of the universe are angular. But the implied symmetries are a six-dimensional group of rotations plus translations. That's an assumption, and of course, there's a logical possibility that we live in a big void or something, and that we think that we see this larger set of symmetries because the universe has conspired against us and put us in the center, but I won't talk about that possibility. So the most general metric, which is consistent with this set of implied symmetries, is the FRW metric. So if you want to describe this universe in a GR context, then you're immediately led to this metric. Where the spatial metric, the three metric, is delta ij in a flat universe, and these symmetries allow the possibility of constant spatial curvature. So I'll write down the generalization to a curved universe slowly. Where the scale factor A of t is a monotonically increasing function. From the Big Bang at A equals 0. To A equals 1 today. I'll let you think about it. I'm not going to prove the theorem that this is the most general metric consistent with these symmetries, but I'll let you think about why that might be true. For example, you couldn't add a term here that mixes x's and t's because this is a three vector and it would define a preferred direction and be inconsistent with the rotational symmetry. I guess I'm sketching sort of a heuristic proof. You couldn't let this prefactor depend on spatial coordinates in addition to the time coordinates, so that would break the translation invariance. The fact that there's no function of t sitting in front of the dt squared is actually, you know, just a gauge choice. I can always choose a time coordinate so that a constant rate of coordinate time corresponds to a constant lapse proper time. The convention to put a equals 1 today, that's also just a choice. Of course, I could rescale a and absorb the change into the definition of the x's. So I'm just defining the x's so that 1 meter of coordinate distance corresponds to 1 meter in the universe today. So the function a of t increases monotonically as t to the 1/2 to t to the 2/3. Finally goes to e to the ht, where the transitions from radiation domination to matter domination to cosmological constant domination happen at around 10 to the 5 years and around 10 to the 10 years. To write the So to write the spatial part of the metric, spatial curvature is parameterized by a constant k with units of length to the minus 2. So this is, you should think of this as co-moving length to the minus 2. The actual physically relevant curvature dilutes as the universe expands as 1 over scale factor squared. So we can either be flat, positive curvature, which corresponds to a 3-sphere of radius k to the 1/2, or have negative curvature, which means that we live in this hyperbola. The metric, so these spaces all have a six-dimensional symmetry group, which is intuitively a group of translations and rotations. So the symmetries link any 2 points in the space. And they also allow for full rotational symmetry around any point in the space. So the relevant symmetry groups are SO4 in the positively curved case, SO3-1 in the negatively curved case, and E3, the non-compact group of translation and rotation symmetries in Euclidean 3 space. There's a high degree of symmetry, but I'll write the metric in a form where that symmetry is not manifest, because that's what's calculationally convenient. One way of writing the metric is in polar coordinates. If I'm an observer sitting at any point of the space, the symmetries, of course, make all points equivalent. So around any point, I can choose polar coordinates, so that the metric the spatial part of the metric looks like this. Where d omega 2 squared is the standard sine theta d phi, the angular part of the metric and spherical polar coordinates. And this function is chi for k equals 0. Positive k and this function s of chi is an analytic function in the two variables k and chi. So this form of the metric, I think, is at least in the positively curved case, is easy to just sort of write down intuitively. If I step out the variable chi here, the radial coordinate just corresponds to physical distance by which you step out from the origin. And on a sphere of radius k to the 1/2, if I step out a distance chi, then the angular dimensions are smaller compared to what they would be in a Euclidean space. The volume of this two-sphere, the radius of this two-sphere, is just reduced by the geometric factor sine of the radius of the sphere, which is k to the 1/2. Sorry, this should be k to the minus 1/2. If I step out by a distance chi, then the radius of this angular two-sphere is reduced by a factor equal to sine of chi over the radius of the sphere, which is what this is. You can also, an alternate radial coordinate, which is usually more calculationally convenient, is to the variable r, which is actually equal to s of chi. I haven't chosen notation to indicate that. But if I let this factor s, that's the radius of the sphere, be the radial coordinate, if I make that change of variables, then I get this form. So if curvature is non-zero, there are two radial coordinates. There's chi, which is the metric distance that you step out. So that determines how far you have to travel to reach an object. And there's r, which determines for an object displaced from you how physical distances at the location of the object translate to angular deflections that you observe. So this second form is convenient for calculations. For example, you can write down, you can translate this if you write out the dr squared and the d omega 2 squared explicitly. You get this simple closed form for the metric. Okay. R squared. From this formula, you can invert the matrix and show that the inverse metric is given by this explicit formula. A basic property is that the universe of the FRW metric is that the universe has a rest frame. That's a property of the FRW metric, but it's also an observed property of the universe. We see a CMB dipole because we're moving relative to some rest frame in which the CMB, at least the lowest order, would appear uniform. A co-moving observer is an observer whose world line is just defined by x of t equals constant, or equivalently, therefore, velocity is equal to 1. So for a cool moving observer, there are two notions of distance. There's coordinate distance, or cool moving distance, between two observers. Is the distance that they would measure between them if they waited until today to make the measurement. And then, of course, there's a physical distance if they measure at some earlier time. The physical distance they measure is A of t times delta x. When I write it without, when I write coordinates without any subscript, I always mean you know, the coordinate system of in which this metric is defined. A few more definitions. Of course, the Hubble parameter. It's just A dt. The fractional increase in the scale factor per unit time. H inverse is a characteristic cosmological scale. It's in units of distance around 4,000 megaparsecs today, or 14 gigayears today. The age of the universe, more or less independent of the details of its expansion history, is an order one constant times this number. And the size of the universe today is an order one constant times this number. And those statements are true at any point in the universe's evolution. The stress energy of the universe is parameterized by two functions of time. So rho of t is the physical energy density, the energy per unit physical volume. Not co- writing physical volume to emphasize that it's not, I don't mean co-moving volume. And the pressure P of t. Is the force per physical area. An observer measures if they put down a little plane and let particles crash into it and bounce off. So the GR stress energy tensor, the stress energy tensor with these variables looks like this. T, Q lower edge, is A squared P of T G I J, or P of T A of T squared gamma I J. I use gamma to denote the spatial three metric without the scale factor. And this is the most general symmetric tensor consistent with the FRW symmetries, the translation plus rotation symmetries. Okay, so on the basis of symmetry, we were able to write down a metric and its stress energy tensor. The next step is to run the GR machine and see what Einstein's equations, see how to take covariant derivatives, see what Einstein's equations tell us, and so on. So let me just summarize this calculation. So okay, so the first step in running the GR machine is to compute Christoffel symbols. Uh, So if I plug in the FRW metric, then it's not too hard. I did this calculation shortly before the class just to remind myself whether it was hard or easy. And this is an easy calculation to show that with this general form of the Christoffel symbols, if you plug in the specific metric, you get these gammas with all the other gammas zero. Then you can calculate the Ricci tensor. And so here I would claim that, I would say that the brute force calculation, if you just plug in these gammas and start turning the crank, is actually kind of nasty. To avoid a life of infinite algebra, it helps to have a little trick, and the trick which simplifies this calculation is symmetry. So I won't put up the full. I won't go through all the steps, but in advance that whatever tensor you get at the end of this calculation is going to be consistent with the symmetries of the FRW metric. So that doesn't allow an R0i. You don't have to calculate that. R00 and Rij. So R00 can be an arbitrary function of time, no spatial dependence allowed. And Rij can be an arbitrary function of time times the metric gamma ij. That's the most general spatial two tensor that's consistent with the statements that if I translate from any point to any other point, I have to get the same tensor. And if I rotate around any point in a way, if I apply a linear transformation around any point that preserves the metric, it also has to preserve Rij. The big simplification is that in this calculation is kind of nasty only because the curvature can be non-zero. Is that if I use these coordinates, the r coordinates, then it suffices to calculate everything at r equals zero, which reduces the number of terms a lot when you start taking derivatives and multiplying Christoffel symbols. There's a bunch of terms that go away. Once you have that, it's straightforward to compute the Einstein tensor. And then get Einstein's equation, write down Einstein's equations. Which are h squared, a dot over a squared. So this is the famous Friedman equation that tells you how energy density drives the expansion of the universe, with the curvature is sometimes thought of as a source of stress energy which dilutes as 1 over a squared, which is what you would expect if you live on, say, a sphere with constant comoving radius whose scale factor a of t is increasing with time. The observationally relevant curvature is going to go as 1 over a squared. And then this acceleration equation, by the way, this acceleration-like parameter, where W is, by combining these two equations, if I take the derivative of the first one and use the second one to eliminate the term with two a derivatives, then I get a, I get this equation, which just relates the rate at which stress energy dilutes in A to the equation of state of the universe. So W here is P over rho, the equation of state. And this, of course, is equivalent to the continuity equation. In order for Einstein's equations to be self-consistent, the stress energy tensor, the covariant derivative of the stress energy tensor has to be zero with this contraction. So it's easier to think about Einstein's equations as you could think of them either as a first order differential equation and a second order differential equation in the scale factor, or in the presence of the first equation, the second equation is equivalent to the continuity equation. So you can also think of Einstein's equation as a first-order differential equation for the scale factor, plus a first-order differential equation that the matter density must satisfy in order to be to drive the metric self-consistently. It's helpful to have explicit formulas for a single component universe with constant W, so i.e. P equals W rho, where W is not a function of time. So in this case, the continuity equation determines the evolution of rho. So from the continuity equation, if W is a constant, then this just integrates to give rho of t proportional to k of t to the minus 3, 1 plus W. And now you can integrate Friedman's equation. To get a of t proportional to t to the 2 over 3 times 1 plus w. Or in the special case, w equals minus 1 exponential expansion where h is constant. This is the sitter. This is the de Sitter case where I'm describing de Sitter 3 plus 1 dimensional de Sitter space with constant h, or more properly, a patch of the global de Sitter. Okay. Now, that's the case of constant W. In our universe, life is not quite so simple. So rho is the sum of matter radiation and cosmological constant components, which scale was a to the minus 3, a to the minus 4, and 0 powers of a. And of course, to get the pressure, you just weight each guy by W, where W is 0 for the non-relativistic matter pieces, 1/3 for the radiation piece, and minus 1 for cosmological constant piece. As the universe evolves, the components with more powers of A start to win, leading to the behavior and the exponents that in this figure, the exponents are just the factors of 2 over 3 times 1 plus W in the different regimes. These four numbers are the parameters of the expansion history in the lambda CDM model. If you're a physicist, you would probably find it most natural to use these four parameters, the energy densities of the various components today. But I've become hardwired to use the astro parameterization. And depending on which papers you read, you may find either one. The expansion history is written a redundant parameterization in which capital omega of a component is its energy density today over the sum of the other guys, so the fractional energy density today. So this is redundant. There's one more parameter because the sum of the omegas has to equal 1. Myself into a corner. The little h determines the present day expansion rate by the Hubble parameter today is 100 h kilometers per second per inverse megaparsec. With these funny units, because I'm imagining that I'm an astronomer that's measured the recessional velocity of, say, a galaxy via its spectral lines in units of kilometers per second, and then I'm dividing by h to get its distance in megaparsecs. Physical densities, the two parameterizations are just related by the density of a species today is its omega times the total energy density today, which by Friedman's equation is 3 over 8 pi g h naught squared. And this is omega. So the reason for this weird parameterization, as I understand it, for parameterizing the total energy density this way is that, I could be wrong, but I think that this dates back to a time where the Hubble constant today was a very badly determined parameter. The distance ladder wasn't tied down yet. So if you imagine being in a situation where you don't know this number, you don't know what h is, but you imagine that you know the omegas better, then you might want to report. So suppose I measure, for example, the recessional velocity of some galaxy and determine it to have a redshift of 0.1 with a tiny statistical error, say 1%. When I divide by H naught to get a distance, then I would report the distance as say as 300 plus or minus 1% H inverse megaparsecs. Whereas if I absorbed the H and wanted to report the distance in megaparsecs, I would have to report it as 400 plus some huge statistical error plus 100% statistical error. So in a world where everything is sort of pinned down besides this one number, it makes sense to tailor your system of units so that you're always bookkeeping the power of H in which your measurement is precise. And this has sort of stuck with us. For example, because I'm used to this weird system of units, I know that a physical energy density always has an H squared in it, for example. I don't think this makes much sense. This way of bookkeeping is necessary nowadays, where H is determined to about 1%, the same degree of accuracy as the other parameters. There's nothing really special about H. But nevertheless, the historical convention has stuck with us, and we always sort of bookkeep what power of H appears in different quantities, like the distance measured to a galaxy with a given redshift. Perhaps sort of a weird historical artifact, but you'll get used to it. Okay. Okay. Let's talk about geodesics in the FRW metric for 5 minutes or so. So the geodesic equation just says that the covariant derivative, a path is a geodesic if the covariant derivative of its four velocity along the path is zero, which written out in components is this equation, the geodesic equation. Along a geodesic, which could be either a time-like or a light-like geodesic. The covariant speed of the particle, or v dot v, is conserved. And this is zero for a massless light-like geodesic. And negative for a time-like geodesic. So I can always choose the normalization so that the affine parameter lambda, so that this quantity is minus m squared, and then interpret and then if I write out that contraction on the left-hand side in components, then these factors in parentheses will just be the energy squared and the physical momentum squared, measured by a co-moving observer at some space-time point along the world line of the geodesic. physical. We'd like to integrate the geodesic equation and determine how geodesics evolve. There's a nice statement that covers both the time-like and light-like cases, which is that if the geodesic equation is satisfied, the momentum P just always redshifts as 1 over A. For both massless particle, a massive relativistic particle, a massive non-relativistic particle, this is always exactly true. Let's derive this. I derived it as follows. If I take the zero component of the geodesic equation, so the derivative of the energy is the derivative of dx0 d lambda, which if I just plug into the geodesic equation, I get this right-hand side. Taking the FRW metric, the Christoffel symbols that I computed before, I get this. Which I can recognize as minus a dot over a p squared. It takes a little playing around. You need a little playing around here. I decided to just start by taking the derivative of the energy and seeing what I got. If I wanted an equation for dp d lambda, then I could just, since this is conserved, I can just, since e squared minus p squared is conserved, I can just differentiate with respect to lambda on both sides. And plug in my derivative of the energy to get a formula for dp d lambda. Okay, so great, now I know how both p and lambda evolve. Now it happens to be true if you sort of fiddle with this a little bit that the P equation simplifies. You know, I appear to have a differential equation, a couple differential equations in E and P, but the derivative of P with respect to expansion turns out to have no E in the right hand side. If I just make this change of variables, I get d log A. The factors of h and e turn out to cancel out. P d lambda inverse dp d lambda. The first factor in parentheses here is h. The second factor in parentheses is e. And this is minus a dot over a p. So there's a convenient cancellation here, and you just get minus p on the right-hand side, which you can immediately integrate to get p proportional to 1 over a. So this statement that redshifts decay as 1 over a, that you know energy e squared minus p squared is always equal to m squared, plus the symmetries of the FRW metric tell you everything you need to know about how geodesics behave. Considering the massless case first, a photon where the momentum is just the frequency, a photon just travels on a null geodesic with a frequency that decays as one over a. In other words, we've derived the redshift effect. A massive particle, say if it starts out relativistic, then its momentum is this quantity always decays as one over a. So if it starts out relativistic, then its gamma factor decays as roughly 1 over a when, after the universe has expanded by a factor of gamma. It transitions from relativistic to non-relativistic. And then after that, you're in the regime where its velocity just shifts as 1 over a, and eventually it comes to rest in the FRW rest frame. I guess I didn't define the redshift yet, but everyone knows what that is, right? This is sort of the observer's time coordinate. So depending on what calculation you're doing, different time coordinates may be convenient, either proper time t, conformal time tau, which I'll put up in a sec, or the scale factor a may be the most convenient time coordinate to use. If you're an observer that's looking out and measuring spectral features, then the most convenient time coordinate to use is A, but it's conventional to define the redshift Z by A equals 1 over 1 plus Z, so that 1 plus Z is the fractional shift, the observer's time coordinate, the fractional redshift. Let's talk a little bit about the causal structure of an FRW metric. So a light like geodesic we found out how its affine parameter evolves, or equivalently how its physical frequency evolves. If we just want to study the trajectory traced out by the geodesic, then if it moves at the speed of light, its physical position per unit time, or equivalently, A times the coordinate distance per unit of time is equal to 1. And so the light cone in the xt coordinates is a curved thing with slope proportional to 1 over A. So an interesting question to ask is, are the past and future light cones bounded or unbounded? I better specify that the question I'm asking is, are they unbounded or bounded in the co-moving sense? Okay. So I'm asking whether this integral converges or diverges, the integral of dt over a, which is the integral of dA over a squared h. Now at either the future or past end, this integral will be dominated by some component with constant equation of state W. So let me replace H here. Let's see, so the energy density always, let me drop a constant factor and just say proportional to. The energy density always goes as a to the minus 3 times 1 plus w. And then Friedman's equation says that h is proportional to the square root of the energy density. So I end up with 3 times 1 plus w over 2 here. Or the integral of a to the minus 1 plus 3w over 2. Okay. So this integral, I've done this calculation in a way that applies to either the past end, the a equals 0 end, or the a equals infinity end. So the magic value of w is minus 1/3, where this integral is dA over A. That's the case where you have a log divergence at both ends. If w is greater than that magic value, if the integral is, then the integral is more rapidly growing than dA over A in the future, less rapidly growing in the past. And I have a, the light cone is bounded in the past and unbounded in the future. If w is less than minus 1/3, then exactly the opposite is true. Unbounded in the past, bounded in the future. So if we were asking this question in, say, 1975, we would say that in the past, we didn't know about inflation yet. So in the past, we would say the universe was radiation dominated. W is 1/3. And in the future, the universe will be matter dominated. W is 0. Both of these numbers are greater than minus 1/3. And so we would have a universe in which light cones, I'm still using proper time, so I'll draw the light cones curved, where the light cones are infinitely large in the universe. If you wait long enough, you see the whole universe, but finite in the past when you run all the way back to the Big Bang. A equals 0. So we have the horizon problem. I guess we should add the statement that the CMB is formed much closer to the Big Bang than it is than to us. So we have the horizon problem that the surface of last scattering appears to be a large number of causally disconnected regions, leading to the question of why it looks isotropic at the 10 to the minus, a few parts in 10 to the 5. There's also the problem that it's past geodesically incomplete. If I just have a co-moving observer here and run his clock backwards, then he reaches a singularity in finite time. Now in 2015, both of these statements are reversed. We now think the universe started with an inflationary phase, or that's at least one popular possibility, where W is minus 1. And the universe will end in a dark energy dominated, its phase. Also, W equals minus 1. It's like De Sitter on both ends. Light cones in the past are infinite. The surface of last scattering of our CMB is all causally connected. But in the future, there's a finite horizon you can never observe. And the asymptotic future of our universe is a De Sitter space where we have an infinite or, possibly, I suppose, another logical possibility would be a very large closed universe consisting of a bunch of causally disconnected patches, roughly the size of our current Hubble, because the cosmological constant today is an order one number times our current Hubble. Okay. I suppose I better. I have two more pages left. There's this phenomenon where you make notes ahead of time. It seems like you're going to finish everything in like 20 minutes, but then you write on the board and there's a time dilation effect. So I'll finish reviewing this homogeneous universe FRW tomorrow, and then I'll review some quantum mechanics stuff, and then we'll start talking about models of inflation. Thanks.